Hi, everybody. This is Steve Savitsky, and welcome to Savitsky Talks. And today we have Naomi Ross, who is actually a cooking instructor and a food writer. And she teaches a lot of classes throughout the tri-state area, and she writes articles all about food, and she's like a food guru. So how are you? How's everything? Okay?
Good. Everything's great. Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. So first of all, how did you become a cooking instructor, food guru, et cetera?
Well, it's funny. You know, it never really was my intention to become a career, but life takes you in funny places and directions, I guess. It really started as like a community service kind of thing that I had developed for new brides when I was living in Boston about, say, 12, 13 years ago. And I saw that there were a lot of new young brides in the neighborhood that really were overwhelmed with cooking and their new household responsibilities. And I thought, like, you know, I love cooking. I love the whole art of homemaking, so to speak. And I offered to them, when I noticed them commiserating one Shabbos, I offered them, like, putting together a little crash course for them. And I thought, you know, we'll call it Cooking for Kalas. And it was really a community service kind of thing that I put together. And I didn't even charge them. And after I taught it to them, I realized, holy cow, I love this. This is amazing. It really just spoke to me, and I felt very comfortable teaching, and I felt very comfortable with what I had to give over and being in the kitchen. And from there, it just developed and developed and grew and grew. And then when I moved to New York, I kept developing classes. I started teaching at different places like, the course that I had developed, I still continued to teach out of my house, but then I started being asked to teach at different places like in Brooklyn. I don't know if you've heard of it, the Center for Kosher Culinary Arts.
No, I've never heard of it. Okay.
So they're the only kosher cooking school in America.
Really?
And at the time, they asked me to start teaching there. It was mostly recreational classes, and now it's mostly actually professional training classes now. But I still teach there for recreational classes. And then in addition, you know, JCCs and different demonstrations and community demonstrations all over the area. And so one thing led to another, and I always loved writing. So when people started asking me to contribute articles and recipes, it was a natural transition for me, and it was something that I just really I always enjoyed the writing. So
that's great. So yeah. Something you love has become a profession, and there's nothing better than that. That's really
that's great
terrific.
When it works out that way.
That's
and terrific. I still try to maintain the focus of sort of synthesizing, you know, giving meaning and a little bit of spirituality, a little bit of Jewish feeling and importance to whatever cooking classes I'm teaching. So that's really still my focus, and I try to do that in my articles as well.
That's great. So, and where do you write your articles? Where are they?
Well, I write a regular column. It's about, I would say, a monthly column. I would say every 4 or 5 weeks. For Bina Magazine's food. They have a relish section, so I write for them like a how-to instructional column. And then I started last year writing for Joy of Kosher Magazine.
Sure, great.
And then I do freelancing, like, for the OU Action.
Great. Well, that's good. Well, we're happy to have you and writing an article. And as I told you, you know, what we do is, you know, I usually interview people, and then hopefully when people read the article and they say, wow, that really looks interesting. I wonder what Naomi Ross is all about. And guess what? They could just go click right on. They get this beautiful interview. We spend a few minutes together talking about it. And then who knows? Maybe even people are going to give you a call. We'll talk about that in a second. But the article you wrote was really a little different. It was really interesting, by the way. They sent me a copy, so I have a chance to read it. Lessons from the Syrian Kitchen, Speaking with Pupa Dweck, correct? That's how you pronounce it?
Yes.
And she seems like quite a interesting person.
An author of
the Romans of Aleppo, right? Okay, so tell me, first of all, tell me a little bit about her, because you didn't really, you know, from the article, you kind of got a feel for, you know, what she's doing. But tell me a little bit about her as a person. Who is she?
She's amazing. She's, you know, really from the old school of, you know, her parents were born in Aleppo. She's really from the Aleppian community. I believe grew up in Brooklyn in the Syrian community there. Her parents had moved from Aleppo and really raised her within that community, really transferring and giving over all their traditions. And the Syrian community there, and especially at that time, was so tight-knit. It's still tight-knit. But it was really, really given over to her in such a special way. And it really was never her intention to make a career out of it either, in terms of her book writing. But she conveyed to me that it was really at the point that she saw that the whys and the traditions for certain things that were very commonly made, but the significance and the background was being lost a little bit, having been removed from Aleppo. And she really wanted to capture the history and the culture, not only the recipes, but uniting all of them together and giving it over back to the community so that they had a memory and a real record of where everything came from. Mm-hmm. And the more she researched and the more she gathered information, the more she has really become like a Jewish food historian of sorts for the Syrian community.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. That's really interesting. So interesting because you always hear about Aleppo, and then, of course, because of the terrible situation in Syria today, you realize that city was one of the major cities that was destroyed. And now I know there are no Jews living there, but I don't know how many people are living there. It was a major, major city, and now, it's almost like a wasteland. It's really
incredible. It's sad. It's really sad, especially having spoken to her and how richly she describes life there. Now that there's no more Jewish community there, she said it's really the first time in like 3,000 years that there's no Jewish presence there. Right. And much like some of the other neighboring regions, like also in Iraq, you take a look at cities like Baghdad that were really, or any of the regions there that were the heart of Babel. Like it was a hugely rich Jewish community that so much has been lost in terms
No question about it. So when you normally think of Syrian food, okay. And I say, wow, it must be pretty hot, spicy kind of stuff. Is it really?
So when I think of Syrian food, I don't think of spicy in terms of like I would Moroccan food or, and it's interesting for me in this Jewish action issue that I wrote this article. I also did a book review for Barbara Ben-Susan's memoir about her journey as an Ashkenazic woman having married a Moroccan Jew, and it's interesting to compare their descriptions of both of their cuisines because they're both Sephardi cuisines, but very different. And so when I think of, things like Moroccan food, I think spicy, harissa and a lot of red pepper paste and things like that. When I think of Syrian food, I think of a lot of sweet and sour, a lot of very bold flavors that are contrasting. The use of, and she talks a lot about it, the use of tamarind paste is a major agent in their sweet and sour flavoring. So they'll do a lot of sweet dishes and then add a souring agent like tamarind paste to balance it. And that acidity but especially the tamarind is a very, very unique taste. Unlike in the Persian community where they'll use pomegranate molasses to give that little bit of sweet and sour kind of feel. So the Syrian cooking is very, very distinctive in terms of their use of tamarind. And also they use a ton of spices that, especially as an Ashkenazic cook, it was like news to me. It was a real eye-opener. They use a lot of allspice.
You mean new things that you never heard of before?
Either things I had never heard of or just, I mentioned this in the article I wrote. I grew up with a real Ashkenazic upbringing. Both of my families came from Poland, from Russia, from regions that really were not known for their culinary prowess. Like the accessibility of exotic ingredients was pretty much I would say any Ashkenazic Jew in this area. You ask them about exotic ingredients, and they're not going to have that much to tell you. Onions, potatoes, like that's what we had. We didn't have.
That's for sure, right?
We didn't have the access to this amazing spice market that like you would find in Aleppo, they were at a crossroads, and they were also in the Fertile Crescent. So like they had amazing access to all different, the whole spice route and all the different trade that went through. And so, fresh spices was like the lifeblood of their food. So all spices very prominently used. They use a lot of, a lot of different spices. I mean, also, I would say in Moroccan cooking, but, colorful food, nicely, heavily spiced food, it's a very big contrast, I think, for someone coming from an Ashkenazic background.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask you a question about something I thought was really interesting in the article. When you talked to her, she was talking about the fact that, so people came from Aleppo, and they kept the, traditions, and they kept a lot of the food and the cuisine. And, of course, America is the melting pot, so the second generation moved away from that, but somehow it caught on again, and the third generation, and now the fourth generation, it has a renewed interest. How did that happen?
It's something that was really interesting for me to talk to her and pick her brain about, especially because I really had very little knowledge of the Syrian community before my conversations with her. And I feel like in general, it's a very closed community, and I don't mean that in a bad way, and I mean it in a good way. Meaning that part of their being a little bit closed as a community has also helped them preserve their community. They take tremendous pride in their traditions. They take tremendous pride in their recipes. They really, really want to preserve it, and one of the things that I took a lot of inspiration from was the sincerity of the esteem with which they regard their traditions and their cooking, especially from coming from the women. Like, I had a Syrian friend growing up, and I remember her saying that, like, they cooked a lot. But I didn't really understand what that meant at the time. And but the more, like, I spoke to Pupa and spoke to other people, especially, like, in Deal, New Jersey, I've done demonstrations at Hillel Yeshiva there. And the esteem and the joy that they talk about their food, it's not just because they like food. It's because there's, like, a masseur that they've managed somehow to pass down that has established the importance and significance of what it means. Like, did you ever wonder why there's no Syrian restaurants?
Tell you the truth, no. But okay, that's a good question. There are no Syrian restaurants?
Have a huge bustling Syrian community, both in Brooklyn and also in Deal. Why are there no Syrian restaurants to get takeout from? You won't find it. Okay. Why? Not to say that there aren't certain things that are, ingredients that are maybe partially prepared or things that they can use for convenience, but they're obviously Syrian markets, but why are there no sit-down Syrian restaurants? And the reason, I think, is because there's so much associated with home and tradition with their cooking that it's like if the Syrians want to eat out, then that's like they'll go for Chinese. Like,
they'll go for a Franken burger. Okay, I got you.
That's their takeout, meaning they're not going to mess around. The Syrian food is like kadosh. Like, that's what they're preparing in their homes. Right, and you don't mess with that.
Well, that's a very that's an interesting point. I didn't realize it. Didn't know that there were no Syrian restaurants, but that's a very good point. You're right. There's no question that the meal and everything, the preparation, you speak about that also, and you talk about something which you called, I don't know how to pronounce it. It was suffeh, literally orderliness.
Yeah, it's one of those words that is lost in translation. Meaning, they pronounce it suffeh. So suffeh is like the highest compliment that you could give to a Syrian woman. Why? Because it doesn't just mean orderliness. Very much in the same way that tzniut doesn't mean modesty, right? That's one definition, but it doesn't encapsulate what it really means. It's a concept, right? So it's hard to encapsulate suffeh just by translating it as orderliness, because really what it means is the combination of orderliness, being a geschicht, I have to throw in a Yiddish word because that's where I'm coming from. But
you said geschicht?
Geschicht means...
Yeah, right.
Like,
geschicht, everything means... Geschicht means It's all put together, very, very put together person, someone who's geschenkt, you know?
Right, so it's that in terms of how she hosts and runs her home, but it's much, much more than that, as described to me by Pupa. She describes it as being very keenly in touch with a woman's bina.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that it's not just the physicality of how she runs her home and the success and the grace with which she does it, but it's also the esteem and the understanding of what her role is as a Jewish woman.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot more women in the Syrian community working now than there ever were. But somehow they seem to have kept intact their priority in terms of understanding, I am the Jewish woman, and this is like the ultimate, consummate thing I can do is in establishing a Jewish home, whether or not I'm working, no matter how long my hours are, but my biggest priority is making sure that my home is strong.
Your home is your castle, basically.
And you're
in charge of that home. That's your role.
But they associate their food preparation with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is a lot lost in our community.
Mm, interesting. How would you say the differences between the Syrian woman and the Ashkenazic woman in general, as far as marriage is concerned? I mean, I know we're talking about cuisine and cooking, but I mean, so much has to do with, you know, the perception and their role. And would you say their role has always been seen as more of the, you know, the homemaker, the CEO of their house in every aspect?
I think so, but I don't want to really give an answer in terms of that. Not because I don't want to answer you, but because I don't feel like I'm qualified to say. I don't have enough exposure, and I'm not in the Syrian community enough to answer that question appropriately.
Oh, okay.
I will say that definitely, and when I've spoken to different Syrian women and to Pupa, definitely things have been impacted in their community by the fact that women for a long time did not work. And now more Syrian women are working than ever before. But there was definitely, I think, a big, big difference in terms of the amount of women who were at home. And in terms of how that
I hear what you said. I think it's a really great point. But, you know, I mean, it's a fascinating, fascinating article. I think that it kind of gives us some kind of an insight into their life and their lifestyle, because the cooking is not just cooking, the eating is not just eating, it's more. There's a spirituality to it, there's a tradition to it. You know, every course has a different history to it. You can probably give a lecture about how each product or each, you know...
Which
is fascinating. And I appreciate your writing the article and kind of enlightening our readers as to how this works, and it's been a fascinating conversation. I've enjoyed it immensely, and good luck to you in your cooking and your teaching and everything else, and you should continue to enjoy it the way you do now. So thank you. We've been talking to Naomi Ross.
My website is
Let's guess. Okay. So if people want to get in touch with Naomi Ross, here's how we do it. Go ahead.
Sorry. My website is koshercookingconcepts.com. And I am available for demonstrations, classes, and all kinds of writing opportunities. And I would love to be able to cook and write for you.
Terrific. Thank you. Have a great, great day. Thank you so much. Okay?
Thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye.